This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The president hits the heartland in an armored bus. Bachman knocks out Teapaw, and Rick Perry cries treason. It's Wednesday and time for a
pretty ugly
edition of the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to recap the week in politics. He's bobbing the waves on vacation, so we turn again to NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. The weekend produced one winner, one dropout, and one fresh face in the GOP presidential field, Bachman, Pawlenty, and Perry, respectively. The president followed the GOP to Iowa as his reelection campaign starts to roll. Call us and tell us about the president's strengths and weaknesses as a candidate. The phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And recall summer ends in Wisconsin and redistricting battles heat up. In a few moments, we'll speak with Washington Post columnist Michael Gerson about electability, political purity, and the Republican base. Later in the program, John Sayles on his new film set in America's war in the Philippines, Amigo. But first, guest political junkie Ron Elving joins us here in Studio 3A. And Ron, nice to have you back.
Pleasure to be with you, Neil.
And we start with actual votes when we've got them. And we have a final tally in Wisconsin where overall 9 state senators faced recall elections.
That's right. Yesterday, 2 Democratic senators, state senators, were facing recalls. And Jim Holperin up in the Northeastern District, the 12th Senate District, was reelected. And Robert Wirch, down in the southeastern corner of the state, down near Kenosha and Pleasant Prairie, he got reelected as well. Now, Wirch didn't really have too much trouble. He got almost 60% of the vote. But the Jim Holperin vote over Kim Cimac was a tight one, came down to just a little over 50% for the incumbent. But where that leaves us is that since a week ago, the Republicans won 4 out of those contests, the 6 contests for Republican seats. They held on to their margin. It is what you might call, and this is the cliche, a razor-thin margin. It went from 19 to 14 seats for the Republicans in the state Senate to just 17, 16, the minimum.
And what message does it send? This was a close but no cigar or a whiff?
You know, it really depends on which way you want to look at it. From the standpoint of a lot of Wisconsin Democrats, they came within 2,000 votes of taking back the seats they needed to take in their recall forward movement and their offensive. And if they had just gotten 2,000 votes more, it would be seen, of course, as the death knell of Scott Walker, perhaps the death knell of the entire Tea Party movement, of overstatements, surely. But as it is, they're being seen as having failed, as having fallen short, that organized labor wasted millions and millions of dollars on this campaign, and that somehow it means they can't recall Scott Walker, the governor, who would, of course, be their ultimate target. They can't start even circulating the petitions until this November, and they can't submit them until January. So it's still a decision to be made whether or not they want to go that route. In the long run, this may mean it's just a bridge too far and they should concentrate on other races in 2012. We'll have to see.
In the meantime, also, there was a huge amount of outside money poured into races that were, well, very, very local, what, 50,000 votes per district?
50, 60,000 votes, and they were dearly bought because tens of millions of dollars were spent. Now, we saw major labor unions come in, not only public unions, but other unions, because they see this as a forward battleground in the larger struggle over whether or not organized labor and collective bargaining are going to be part of the 21st century, not only for public employees, but also for employees, period. And so this was a huge draw for their money. It was also a huge draw for the money of business interests and ideological groups like Club for Growth, anti-tax groups. Many people who love Scott Walker got involved in as well, and so we saw tens of millions on both sides.
And now the governor is saying, well, let's put all this behind us and get back to bipartisanship. I'm never sure we were at bipartisanship, but that's where he wants to go back to.
Yes, it is an odd word given the very hard press that was made by this newly elected governor to achieve much of his agenda in the early weeks of his first legislative session. He does want to talk about jobs now. He does want to talk about cooperation, and to some degree with the 17-16 state Senate, and with the desire of dissuading people from recalling him or attempting to recall him next year, it would be sensible for him to lay out something more of a middle course.
We're getting some results from redistricting. Most places, of course, every 10 years, people's district lines are redrawn for Congress by state legislatures and governors for the most part. As you know, in many places, there is some vicious battles. In some places, there are commissions that's supposed to make it a bipartisan effort. And you expect these fights. This is the most partisan political exercise you can possibly conduct. Some interesting, though, in John Conyers, who has been in Congress, I think, forever, got districted out of his seat.
That's right. He's been there since 1964, nearly half a century, representing Detroit in the main, and is iconic, of course, in terms of the politics of the city of Detroit, African-American politics there. His new district is 80% different from his old district. He's only got about one voter in five of the ones who voted for him in 2010. And the people that have been added to his district are from largely Republican suburbs, including some of the Grosse Pointe communities, which are well known as affluent communities in Michigan in the Midwest. So this would appear to be the death knell for John Conyers, and there is going to be an effort in all likelihood to challenge this map in the courts.
One of the longest-serving members of Congress. In the meantime, the newest member of Congress also got redistricted.
Yes, interesting. The number two long-serving person in Congress in John Conyers, and the very, very newest, Janice Hahn in Los Angeles. She just got elected a matter of weeks ago, really, and she is already finding herself drawn into a district with another Democratic incumbent. Now, California isn't losing a lot of seats, or gaining seats either, for that matter, but because they have this new commission, as you mentioned, they're no longer drawing the districts to protect the incumbents the way the state legislature and the governor and some of the other people involved in these maps in the past have done. So with this new commission drawing communities of interest, you're bound to see some incumbents drawn together, and that includes Janice Hahn. So she's got a decision to make there.
And you expect these battles in places as complicated as California, even with a commission. There's a redistricting fight going on in, of all places, Maine.
That's right. And the only place that would be less likely would be, say, Vermont, where they only have one
or
seat.
Delaware. Yes.
That's right. Or Delaware or Montana, where they just have the one seat. And in Maine, where they have two, they are wrangling largely over whether to draw it vertically or horizontally. Now, in fact, there is a partisan difference here. There's a new commission there, but it's evenly split, and they've got very different ideas about how to draw it. And the Republicans would like to put the two current Democratic members who have the two seats for the state of Maine in the same district, creating, of course, a vacancy, and then pitting the two Democrats against each other in a primary.
Unless one of them should move. But that's another issue. So instead of drawing the state horizontally, dividing it north-south into two districts, they would draw it vertically east-west. And that would put both Democrats on the coastal district.
That's correct. Although, of course, there's still a certain amount of verticality, horizontality.
No matter how you do it.
But the point is that most of the people are towards the seacoast and nearer to the south than way up north.
We'll pay more attention to those as they continue to develop. In the meantime, we're going to be talking with Michael Gerson of the Washington Post about the Republican presidential field when we come back in the next segment. But there is the Democratic candidate as well, and that is Barack Obama, who set out essentially this kicks off his campaign, this bus tour through the Midwest as he followed the Ames straw poll.
That's right. Flew into Minnesota, went down to Iowa, over to Illinois. He is trying to sort of send the signal that he still remembers his days as a candidate when he was starting out in the Iowa caucuses contest of 2007, 2008, trying to stay closer to some of those more populist moments in his career. It's harder to do when you're president of the United States and when your economy is somewhat at sea, when unemployment is over 9%, and when your own personal popularity numbers have just slipped down under 40% in the Gallup for the first time.
Of course, still three times higher than popularity figures for Congress, but that's another issue.
We'll get back to Congress.
In the meantime, at one of his appearances, the president noted the Fox debate just before the Ames straw poll, where they asked, would any of you take a deal where you got a 10-to-1 split spending cuts for revenue increases? Everybody held up their hand and said no. The president had this to say.
My job as president goes beyond just winning the political argument. I've got a whole bunch of responsibilities, which means I have to make choices sometimes that are unattractive. and I know will be bad for me politically.
The president said, that just doesn't make any sense.
Well, and he is rumored to have said, or reported to have said, in some of these negotiations with the House, I'm going to do the right thing here, even if it makes me a one-term president, a phrase which Michelle Bachmann likes to repeat rather often. This is a president who, while he might have wanted at one time to think of himself as a consensus builder and tried to build bridges between the parties, has found himself, by a combination of the behavior of his own party and certainly by the resistance of the other party, cast in a rather partisan mode at the moment.
We are asking callers to tell us the strengths and weaknesses of the president. A tweet from Jamie: Obama's Achilles heel is reconvincing us of his message. His base wants him to fight, not compromise, even if he doesn't win. And he's said to be preparing a package for a major speech in early September that will propose, yes, revenue increases, and says it's not possible to make the cuts we need without revenue increases. Let's see if we can get Marla on the phone. Marla with us from Palisade, Colorado.
Hi. I think that the president's greatest strength is pragmatism, which is one of the reasons that I very strongly supported and support him. I'm a small business owner, and I like pragmatists. I think it's also his weakness, because he has to work with extremely unpragmatic people who are only interested in hearing their own voices and their own campaigns. And so I think that it's a possible problem for him in getting reelected, because people are... My fellow Americans are very reactionary, and they are not listening enough to pragmatism.
Thank you very much, Marla. Here's an email from Paul in St. Paul. It's simple. If the economy remains in the ditch and unemployment remains high, any of the Republican field can and will beat President Obama in November 2012. And, Ron, I think that's what a lot of Republican candidates are banking on.
That's right. And that is, I think, a factor in why Republicans feel that they can go for someone at this point who is a very strong partisan figure, somebody who is not necessarily seen as a compromiser, someone who is not going to tack back to the center, but someone who would remain true to the core principles of the party all the way through. Whether or not that will prove to be the best course to take a year from now is quite another matter.
And that's what we're going to be discussing when we come back from a short break. We want to hear from conservatives in the audience. As you consider the field of Republicans, what's more important to you, electability in the general election or political purity? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conant. Stay with us. It's the Political Junkie on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And take over this beautiful land. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conant in Washington. A dramatic week in the GOP presidential sweepstakes. Former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty bowed out after a distant third-place finish in the Iowa straw poll. Texas Governor Rick Perry jumped in. He's off and running. The Pawlenty campaign bet on winning Iowa and lost when fellow Minnesotan Michelle Bachmann took the life out of his socially and fiscally minded campaign. Political observers want to know whether Pawlenty's backers will now get behind Texas Governor Rick Perry, the longest-serving governor in the country. He announced in South Carolina, hit Iowa, and he's now in New Hampshire. In the days since his announcement, Republicans say he's the one who can challenge Mitt Romney. Of course, supporters of Ron Paul noted he finished a strong second and that he ought to do pretty well in New Hampshire, too. But anyway, a lot of people face questions about political purity. Romney with questions about his health care plan. Perry on his mandate that girls in Texas get the HPV vaccine. We want to hear from conservatives in the audience. What's more important to you, electability come November or political purity? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Guest political junkie Ron Elving is with us. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Michael Gerson, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, now a columnist for The Washington Post. And it's always nice to have you with us on Talk of the Nation today.
Great to be with you.
And you wrote a piece in yesterday's Post that says something about the GOP that the first candidate out has the most consistent record.
Yeah, I think he was a center-right Republican, at least as governing as governor. And, him leaving first, I think, indicates something. This is the way that both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush won the presidency, by being, strong on certain issues that were appealed to their base, but also doing outreach to the middle. Right now, there's not much of that going on in the Republican Party.
And in fact, you say this is in part a product of where these candidates come from, where they have been elected from. And, for example, it's pretty easy to be an ideological purist if you represent Michelle Bachmann's district in Wisconsin.
Yeah, the most
in Minnesota.
In Minnesota, the most Republican district in her state. You don't have to get more than a little over 150,000 votes. When you're the governor of Minnesota or the governor of Massachusetts and you have to build coalitions, you get involved in issues that aren't typically Republican issues. Pawlenty was an activist on the Republican side on climate change when he was governor. Romney, of course, on health care. And even in Texas, you have Governor Perry that has done a consistent outreach to Hispanics in that state, like George W. Bush did before him, supporting really the Texas version of the DREAM Act in his own state. And that, that's going to come up among conservatives as well. But I think that that's just, it's proof that these people have won in more difficult electoral environments that someone like Michelle Bachmann didn't have to win in.
You said in your column that one of the things that Rick Perry did as governor that you admired was that stance on the HPV virus. He claimed mm-hmm. it was a pro-life issue. It was the health of young girls. And as you wrote that column, he was changing his position.
He backed away from it. And so did Pawlenty, by the way, on climate change, on the human causes of climate change in his own campaign. That's an indication of where the primary is. These are always contests in primaries between electability and purity. And we're leaning towards purity on the Republican side.
It's interesting. Since Rick Perry has gotten into the race, he has sort of scattered sound bites through the blogosphere and on YouTube. This one was his remarks about the Federal Reserve and an issue that quantitative easing, not generally an issue in most presidential elections, but this is what he said. He said it's basically the government printing money.
I mean, printing more money to play politics at this particular time in American history is almost treasonous, in my opinion.
Treason. They shoot people for treason.
I know. It's a little Texas overstatement, which he has not really shown the ability to apologize for or retreat from. I think that shows how he regards his campaign. I mean, he views himself as a Tea Party outsider. It's creating some concerns among establishment Republicans that Mitt Romney wants to take advantage of. And there's talk about other candidates getting in the race for fear of the kind of dynamics within the Republican Party right now.
It's interesting. A lot of that criticism covering from the former president's advisors and staffers, such as yourself.
Well, the Bushies, as one newspaper talked about, have been pretty critical of Perry's comments. But, all politics is local, but sometimes it's also personal. Those of us in the administration, we knew Ben Bernanke. He sat as the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors.
Bush,
He sat as the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in our senior staff meeting. He's a wonderful guy. When people attack him, I think there's a natural reaction there.
Well, attack him or, threaten to treat him as a treasonous person.
Right.
It's a rather extraordinary thing to say, I think, in the usual mix of things that people have said in presidential campaigns, and even Michelle Bachmann and others who do make a strong critique of the current president, strong critique of Democrats, generally have not engaged in language of that kind. So it raises certain questions, and I think one of the questions that it raised with the sudden remarks from Tony Fredo and also Karl Rove and others from the Bush administration.
Pete Wehner, yeah.
Yes, and a number of people was... Mm-hmm. Is there some special reason why there seems to be such bad blood between the last two Republican governors of Texas?
Well, I'm sure there's some history, but a number of those people were not involved in Texas politics forever. I mean, Carl certainly was, but some of the others were not. And I do think that the personal aspect is an important one here. Ben is a very decent man, and to get that kind of abuse is really not good. It is. The broader point here is we're seeing an invasion of a type of immoderate and to some extent intolerant language that we're seeing in our broader political culture that's now invading the presidential election. I mean, we have books where people title them treason. We have a sitting senator that wrote a book.
This goes back. None dare call it treason.
Right. That's true. We have a sitting senator that wrote a book that, Rush Limbaugh, is a big fat idiot. That was the title of the book.
Before he was in the Senate.
That's right.
To be
that's
fair.
True.
He was in the radio dodge in those days.
Exactly. But we're seeing the invasion of that type of language, that kind of approach, into the presidential process. I don't think it's a healthy thing. I think it's divisive. But I think it's where we are, both on the Tea Party side and also other elements, ideological elements in our politics.
Let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. What is more important as you look at the Republican presidential field? Purity, ideological purity, or electability come November 2012? Evan is on the line calling from Boston.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
I think that the most important thing, right, as I'm a fiscal conservative, and I think that the most important thing is ideological purity, because I don't think that people are really going to go for a status quo candidate this year. I think that fiscal conservative is in this year, and that I don't think that if a status quo Republican ran, I don't think he would do as well as somebody that actually is fiscally conservative. So I'm a Ron Paul guy, and I think that he would be the best candidate.
Okay. That obviously, he didn't call treason at the Fed. He just called for the Fed to be eliminated.
That's right. Investigated, which I think Perry has now endorsed. And, I understand that concern. And Ron Paul is certainly the one that is not the status quo candidate. He would certainly, abolish large swaths of the government itself. But there really is no moderate candidate on the Republican side right now. Even someone like Mitt Romney uses very, very conservative arguments when it comes to economics. We're not going to have a status quo Republican in this race, but there is a question whether we're going to have an electable Republican.
In fact, asked if he would have accepted the same debt ceiling deal that Barack Obama had just enacted, Mitt Romney had this to say.
Look, I'm not going to eat Barack Obama's dog food. All right. What he served up was not what I would have done if I'd have been president of the United States.
Which doesn't quite say whether he would have signed it or not, but it's a good soundbite.
Right. No, I agree. Someone like Prime Minister David Cameron in Britain, a conservative, had about $4 or $5dollars in cuts for every dollar in tax increases. I think most conservatives, when you sit down, would accept a deal like that, but they can't say that they would accept that in a Republican primary, given the atmosphere right now.
Here's an email from Peter in Tulsa. I'm a conservative in Oklahoma. I'm very concerned with the overall electability for the GOP field. We have seen that a weak candidate will fail during a Republican wave election, i.e. the Delaware Senate race in 2010. I think that Perry may have the ability to win, even though he has a few downsides on his political purity. But I'm not sure if he keeps attacking the Fed and speaking from the hip that he can win. And Michael Gerson, there's a lot of concern about, well, it's usually referred to as discipline. Can the candidate stay on message? And difficult to do if you're wandering around the state fair talking to everybody who has a microphone.
No, I agree. I mean, there's always a huge test right at the beginning where you make mistakes. Michelle Bachmann has made mistakes and Rick Perry has made mistakes. And the question is how you recover from them. I think Perry's deeper problem is right now he has a largely negative message. You know, he talks about the 10th Amendment, which is about limits of government. He talks about climate skepticism. He's not really offering kind of economic hope beyond austerity, which I think are Republicans going to have to do. That transition may come later in the primary process, but they're going to have to talk about economic growth and job creation in compelling ways in order to win this election. It's not going to be handed to them.
Ron?
The compassionate conservative, that is an element, a dimension of George W. Bush's political persona that I believe to some degree Governor Perry was contemptuous of. Is that not right?
I think that's true. I think that Governor Perry, in both tone and content, really makes Haley Barbour look like a moderate in the context of Southern politics. He's a hardcore Southern conservative with a very strong Texas style. But, you know, people forget that Ronald Reagan had a pretty tough style when he came into politics. Talked about government being the problem, not the answer. Very categorical statement. And that was a year, given high inflation and other challenges, where it was possible for a Republican like that to win. If I were Barack Obama, you know, with 9% unemployment and a stalled recovery, I wouldn't dismiss the possibility of someone like Rick Perry doing quite well in the election.
And people look at the narrowness of the lead that Mitt Romney has in the public opinion polls in any case and say, boy, Rick Perry managed to come from a lot further back and demolish Kay Bailey Hutchison, a much more mainstream Republican.
He's a very tough candidate. I do think, though, that there are a lot of talk among mainstream conservatives now about someone else getting in the race because there's a lack of comfort with Perry and with Bachmann. And people talk about Paul Ryan. People talk about Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey. you know, so I think we're still a little bit unsettled because there's not a broad, you know, happiness with the field itself.
Ron Elving, Paul Ryan talked because the chairman of the Budget Committee asked the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, to not put him on the super committee.
I think it's fair to say that Paul Ryan has receded somewhat as a face in the Republican Party in the House in this whole summer with the whole crisis over the debt ceiling and so on. He was rarely front and center until the actual night of the final vote when he urged his colleagues to vote for the compromise. He, I think, has come to be, for better or for worse, synonymous with the idea of ending Medicare as we know it and making it a premium support program, a largely private insurance program, and that has not been terribly popular from a political standpoint. Might be a viable solution down the road, might be part of any long-term deficit reduction, but not very immediately politically popular. So he seems to have receded a bit. It's not clear that he's the answer, especially because he's personally saying, not at this point in my life, young family, haven't raised any money, and so on. And the idea of taking on Rick Perry at this particular juncture does not look very attractive.
It's Wednesday. The political junkies are with, well, actually, he's in the ocean somewhere.
Bobbing the waves.
Ken Rudin will be back next week. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor, is filling in most ably. Also with us, Michael Gerson, who's a columnist for The Washington Post. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's a couple of tweets. Matt tweets, as a more pragmatic and less social conservative, I am more concerned with the electability of a candidate. Marcus tweets, I choose electability over purity. One of the candidates has to appeal to the middle if the GOP is going to defeat Obama. And that's really a concern, that a candidate in the primary election would box themselves into positions that would cede the political middle to Barack Obama.
No, obviously a party can choose a purist like George McGovern, or they could choose someone like Bill Clinton. And they, you know, parties do both of those things, and they either strengthen or weaken their approach. So I do think, though, that you eventually do get more of a focus on electability in this process. After all, John McCain, who was not very popular with conservatives, won the last time around. Iowa, where everyone's focused right now and where Bachman wins, is not really typical of the Republican Party. It's really dominated by religious conservatives. It has been for quite some time. And so I think that this, as the primaries broaden, you know, there'll be a more of an argument here about the future of the party.
Let's go next to Pete. Pete with us from Inverness in Florida.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that a Republican candidate who runs on true conservative principles will instantly become electable.
Even if that cedes the independent voters in the middle?
I don't think the independent voters are going to drift back to the left side of the political spectrum.
Why not?
Well, I think they've had a little taste of that, and they've seen the results, and I think while they're certainly not ready to join the Tea Party, I think they are drifting and leaning to the right.
All right. Thanks very much, Pete. And is there one candidate you're supporting?
I'm still studying the field.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Bye-bye.
And I
think it's certainly true that President Obama has lost support among independents since his own election last time around. And that's an opportunity for Republicans. But any presidential candidate, this is simplistic, but it's generally true, that any presidential candidate wins by motivating his base while simultaneously reaching out to the middle. That's what Barack Obama did last time. That's what George Bush did, particularly in his first election. Bill Clinton did. And so that's eventually a way that a Republican is going to have to win like everyone else. And some candidates are going to be more capable of doing that than others.
And let's indulge in a little pie in the sky, if you will. Last week, Ron Elving said you could have, in the first three contests, Iowa, New Hampshire, and then South Carolina, three different winners in the Republican field. Maybe Michelle Bachmann, who did well in the straw poll. Maybe Mitt Romney, who has a strong base in New Hampshire. And then maybe Rick Perry in South Carolina. Super Tuesday doesn't exist with the same power as it used to. Could you see this battle extending into June?
Well, if that battle extends in that fashion, I think that Romney would be pretty happy about that. If both Bachmann and Perry remain in this race and fight it out for Tea Party and conservative support, that's probably to the benefit of Romney. I think his concern is whether you have one candidate, whether Rick Perry in particular, can unite Tea Party support with movement conservative, broader movement conservative support, and really make a major challenge to the Republican establishment. That wouldn't be a foregone conclusion. If it's a two-person race in that way, which I'm not convinced it will be, but if it were, that would be much more problematic.
And if you get a situation like that, well, let me be the first. Brokered convention! All right. I've said it. It's out there. Ron Elving, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure, Neil.
Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor, filling in as our political junkie. Ken Rudin will be back next week. Our thanks as well to Michael Gerson, who's a columnist for The Washington Post, who joined us here today in Studio 3A. Michael, as always, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, director John Sayles will join us. His new movie, Amigo, is set in the Philippine-American War has some lessons for current conflicts. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.